rendering to the crown. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Finance Minister Bill Morneau and Treasury Minister Scott Bryson were all on a flight recently on an executive Airbus to a caucus meeting that was being held in British Columbia when Justin Trudeau turns to Bill Morneau and says, chuckling, "You know, I could throw a $1,000 bill out the window right now and make someone happy." Morneau shrugs and replies, "Well, I could throw 10 $100 bills out the window and make 10 people happy." And not to be outdone, Mr. Bryson says, "Well, I could throw 100 $10 bills out the window and make 100 people happy." The pilot just rolled his eyes and said to his co-pilot, "Such arrogant politicians back there. I mean, I could throw all three of them out the window and make millions of people happy." For the record, I'm not advocating throwing politicians out of airplanes, no matter whether we want to or not. However, I must confess that I'm beginning to feel like a broken record of late, lamenting on our current state of political affairs. Although, to be honest, I'm not so concerned about our own political leadership, really, as I am about the leadership, or lack thereof, of our neighbors to the south. Being that this is our national holiday called Canada Day, I find myself once again contemplating the issue of leadership and what qualifies someone to be a good political leader, or any kind of leader for that matter. I'm a firm believer that if you desire a government of good character, then we must elect people of good character to govern. And Jesus said as much when he offered, "Whoever is faithful in a little is faithful in much." I'm sorry if you disagree with me, but I do think that what you do in your private life does have a bearing on your public life, especially when it relates to leadership. I've just begun, in fact, I finished it just this week, to read a book by Eric Geiger called How to Ruin Your Life. And Geiger makes a very important distinction about character. He talks about the difference between an explosion and an implosion. An explosion, we are quite familiar with, it's very dramatic. The debris just goes outward, it blasts outward. An implosion defines a demolition, where the building collapses in on itself. And you've seen pictures of this. Demolition experts will spend days, months even, planning how to plant demo charges in just the right places to bring down an old building in a confined area. It's quite a science. By the time the demolition takes place, considerable effort has been undertaken to prepare for that implosion. The same is true for people whose abhorrent behavior becomes public knowledge. We only see the wreckage now, but long before, the rot and the destruction were underway, eating away at the person's character until the whole thing implodes, collapses. In other words, the scandals we hear about did not happen overnight. We may wonder, at least I do, if faith should matter in our politicians' lives. Abigail Adams, who was wife of the second president of the United States, wrote to her husband in which she made the following observation. "A true patriot," she says, "must be a religious man. I've been led to think that he who neglects his duty to his maker may well be expected to be deficient and insincere in his duty to the public. Even suppose him to possess a large share of what is called honor and public spirit, yet do not these men, by their bad example of loose conduct, corrupt the minds of youth and vitiate the morals of this age, and thus injure the public more than they can compensate with generosity and honor." Unfortunately, as President Rutherford B. Hayes said, nothing brings out the lower traits of human nature than those who are seeking office. Is it any wonder then that you and I, we struggle to know who to vote for in an era when a person's character no longer seems to matter as much as a person's charisma? Which brings us, Laura, thankfully, for your benefit, to our Old Testament lesson today. I actually preached on the gospel lesson about 6 months ago, so I'm going to focus on Jeremiah instead. Judah and Israel, the divided kingdoms, and also when they were one kingdom, had a perpetual problem. They never seemed to be in any consistency in their leadership from their kings. One king would be really good. The next king would be a moral disaster. And sometimes the kings were a mixture of good and bad. And God knew that human rulers were not 100% trustworthy in their righteous behavior. It's one of the reasons, and this may surprise you, that God did not want to have a king over Israel. He didn't want it. If you go back to 1 Samuel 8, you'll discover that the Israelites grumbled and demanded a king so they could be like all the other nations around them. And Samuel warned them that having an earthly king would ultimately lead Israel to stop following God's standards. In verse 18, God says, "When the day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day." Before Saul became king, Israel chose daily to listen to God through the prophet Samuel. Now, they would defer to a fallible human being. God's chief concern in all this seems to be that unless the leader of the people has a heart for God, the people will not have a heart for God. To have a heart for God means an unwavering commitment to do what is right, despite public opinion. The Bible has stories that illustrate the high cost of maintaining integrity. It's all over the place. Twice David had opportunity to capture and kill King Saul. Did you know that? After all the terrible things that Saul had done to David, David refused to raise his hand against the king. Why? Because David knew that Saul was God's anointed king. And only God could decide when that reign was over. You remember Daniel? He was told he had to eat what the king of Babylon offered, but he refused because it was against their food rules. He didn't want to defile himself. When godly principles cease to matter, then ethics, honesty, and integrity disappear. Which brings us to King Josiah's two sons that are mentioned in Jeremiah 22. You might remember that Josiah was one of those good kings I mentioned. He was a great king. These great kings that kind of popped up from time to time. Josiah is recorded as being a righteous man who undertook a major revival of religious reform, including the compilation of religious texts, some of the Bible. He was succeeded by his son, Shalom, who died without having a male heir, so therefore he made way for Josiah's other son, Jehoiakim, to ascend to the throne. Neither Shalom or Jehoiakim were the man their father was. Instead of seeking to serve the people of Judah, they instead exploited the people of Judah. And Jeremiah writes, "Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness and his upper rooms by injustice, who makes his neighbors work for nothing and does not give them their wages, who says, 'I will build myself a spacious house with large upper rooms,' and who cuts out windows for it, paneling it with cedar and painting it with vermilion. Are you a king because you compete in cedar?" You understand that? God's message through Jeremiah is a condemnation of Shalom's exploitation of his own people. He treated them like slaves. Remember, these are the very same people who were delivered out of bondage in Egypt, and now their own king has placed them in bondage. Then God compares Shalom to his father, Josiah, depicting him as the opposite of his father. As Josiah sought to dispense justice and to care for the poor in his kingdom, Shalom only considered his own wants and his own desires. By being so callous with his own people, Shalom shows that he does not care about God's heart one whit. Instead, he chose oppression and violence against innocent people. And God's concern, voiced through Samuel when Saul was anointed king, has come true time and time again. The reality is that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's a quote by John Emmerich Edward Dalberg Acton. I guess the town of Acton is named after him. Godly leadership must always be for the benefit of those being led, not the enrichment of the leader. John Maxwell, who's written extensively on Christian leadership, explains well the difference between godly and ungodly leadership. Godly leadership pursues love and service to others rather than power and prestige. It seeks to improve the welfare of people rather than their own welfare. It sees others as brothers and sisters rather than enemies and competitors. It determines to meet needs and grow the cause rather than remove and kill the opposition. Godly leaders also see power as an opportunity to be faithful. President Woodrow Wilson once said, "If you will think about what you ought to do for other people, your character will take care of itself." There's also a story of Mother Teresa, who was on the streets one day, a street corner in Calcutta, that terrible city of difficult problems. And there were bodies, poor people, laying all over the street. She bent down and began to care for one of the persons who was laying in the street. And a visitor to her mission asked, "Aren't you upset that you can't get to all the bodies, all the people?" She responded, "No, God created us not to be successful, but to be faithful." Shalom the king wanted to be seen by everyone as being successful. Thus he longed for displays of opulence and power, to have his palace rooms lined with cedar. But he displayed no faith in God at all. All leaders, regardless of their political stripe or areas of responsibility, have a choice. And frankly, there's ample evidence that many have chosen quite poorly. Joshua, nearing the end of his life, sums up the choice very clearly, very famous verse. "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." Bob Dylan said it best in one of his songs, "You gotta serve somebody." And if we especially our leaders serve the Lord, then we will have a profound desire for justice. In this very chapter of Jeremiah, verse 3, God speaks to Shalom and says, "Rescue from the hand of his oppressor the one who has been robbed. Do no wrong or violence to the alien, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place." God's desire for justice is repeated hundreds of times in the scriptures, both Old and New Testament. Notice in this verse the covenant formula of caring for widows and orphans and aliens in the land. In Proverbs we read, "Speak up for the people who cannot speak for themselves. Protect the rights of those who are helpless. Speak for them and be a righteous judge. Protect the rights of the poor and the needy." Isaiah states that justice is defined as liberating the oppressed, sharing the resources with the needy, providing shelter for the homeless, supplying clothing to the naked, and seizing, accusing, and judging others. That's what Isaiah said. Doesn't that sound an awful lot like what Jesus said too? In other words, the Bible is consistent on this matter. In the two great commandments of Jesus, loving God is intimately tied to loving our neighbors. They go hand in hand. Our leader's goal in whatever office they hold to or seek to, every effort must be extended to help build up other people, to help them live in health and wellness. And sometimes seeking justice for others means making sacrifices. I had never noticed before, or at the very least, it had never really registered with me, that in Judges chapter 9, there's a parable, a prophetic parable. Many scholars and people call it the parable of the trees. In the parable, the trees decide that they need a king. Does that sound familiar? And so they ask the three most qualified trees that are known, first and foremost, if they're willing to serve as the king. Now, the olive tree felt that his olive oil used for fuel and food and medicine was too important to give that up to be king. The fig tree felt that his cherished fruit, a key agricultural product, highly valued, was too necessary to give up. The vine felt its wine, used not only as a beverage, but also for temple sacrifices, was too precious a thing to give up to serve as king. So the trees asked the lowly bramble bush to be king and rule over them. Now, the bramble bush is a far cry from the quality of those other trees, right? It grows uncontrollably. It's useless. It's fruitless. All it can really do is burn quickly. And while it offers shade, it really doesn't have any shade to offer. But because he was asked, he ruled. The point of the parable is that if other qualified people turn down the opportunity to rule or lead, the vacuum will be filled by people who are not qualified or have nothing to offer. The three qualified trees refused to serve because they refused to sacrifice. They didn't want to give up their current job or their status or their contribution. The unwillingness to sacrifice is when we end up with less than stellar leadership. Does that sound familiar? A.W. Tozer suggests that a true and safe leader is likely to be the one who has no desire to lead, but who is forced into the position of leadership by the inward pressure of the Holy Spirit. I believe it might be accepted as fairly reliable rule of thumb that the man, and I would add woman, who is ambitious to lead is disqualified as a leader. Tozer's words give me pause in consideration of all leadership, even leadership in the church. Willingness does not equal competency. Finally, maybe in our secular world it is too much to hope for, but a godly leader would certainly be one who would have a passion for prayer, wouldn't you think? Nehemiah was one such leader. The book of Nehemiah opens with a scene. During the month of Shezlev, it says, in the 13th year that Artaxerxes ruled Persia, I was in the fortress city of Susa when my brother Hanani came with some news from Judah. So I asked him about the city of Jerusalem. They told me those captives who have come back are having all kinds of trouble. They are terribly disgraced. Jerusalem's walls are broken down. The gates have been burned. When I heard this, I sat down and cried. Then for several days I mourned. I went without eating to show my sorrow, and I prayed. For a godly leader, prayer is job one. Nehemiah did not know what to do until he consulted God. And dare I suggest that none of our political leaders know what they're doing until they consult God. There are mysteries that we humans cannot understand on our own. And no number of experts can solve every situation. Isaiah 47 reads, "You are powerless in spite of the advice you get. Let your astrologers come forward and save you, those people who study the stars, who map out the zones of the heavens and tell you month to month what's going to happen. They will be like bits of straw and fire will burn them up. They will not be able to save themselves. The flames will be too hot for them, not a cozy fire to warm themselves by. They will leave you and go your own way, and none will be left to save you." Jeremiah said basically the same thing in the chapter before us today. Verse 22 reads, "But if they had stood in my counsel, they would have proclaimed my words to my people and would have turned them from their evil ways and from their evil deeds." The point is this. On this Canada Day, that whatever leadership role we undertake or we elect someone to, our skills, our policies, our contacts are nowhere near as important as whether our leaders are godly. That goes for politicians, it goes for teachers, it goes for parents, bosses, ministers, frankly, all our leaders. If a leader's foundation is not solid, there will be nothing there to hold them to last. You know, a few years ago during coverage of the widespread devastation of Hurricane Andrew in Florida, do you remember that? There was a news crew who found in this one neighborhood one home that was completely unscathed. I mean, it was still standing. When asked why his house was still standing, the man, the owner of the home, said this. It's incredible. "I built this house myself. I also built it according to Florida state codes. When the code called for 2x6 trusses, I used 2x6 roof trusses. I was told that a house built according to this code could withstand a hurricane. I did, and it did." Psalm 127 says, "Unless the Lord builds a house, its builder labors in vain." So on this day, when we sing, "God keep our land," do we mean it? And if so, shouldn't we demand of our leaders at whatever level they serve that they turn to God too?